Good evening. Thank you for coming. It's good to be here with you. I live in Gainesville, Florida, and I'm on the road quite a bit. I just came from Denver, Colorado. I was there for a trial. You might have heard about the three Dominican nuns. I was at their trial. They're friends of mine. They were arrested last October for entering a Minuteman missile silo and taking carpenter's hammers and hammering on the rails that move a 110-ton missile concrete missile silo cover. So they hammered on the rails. They had two colonels that were in charge of the operation take the stand. Both acknowledged that they did nothing that ultimately interfered with the security of the United States of America. They were quite proud to say that. But they were still found guilty by a jury after the judge ruled over and over and over again not to allow them to speak, to tell their story, to tell why they did it, to talk about international law and all that stuff. And so they're found guilty of two charges, sabotage and injury to the national security. And they're facing 30 years in jail. They've already been in jail since October. They're going to go back to jail until July when they'll be sentenced. And then at that time, they'll receive their sentence and go back on to jail again. So it's quite a shocking moment to be there and to witness this. These women are unbelievable, really unbelievable. And their courage is just beyond anything I've ever witnessed. Let me take a minute and tell you a little bit about myself before I get started here with this, what I'm doing. I grew up in a military family. I was a young Republican, actually, in 1968. Living in the panhandle of Florida. It's so conservative there, they call it Lower Alabama. And I was working on the Nixon's campaign. I was the vice chair of the Okaloosa County, Florida Young Republican Club. And I did such a good job working on the Nixon campaign that they had this big fish fry fundraiser for Nixon. And they had a guest speaker. And they asked me to sit at the head table along with him as a reward for my hard work on the Nixon campaign. The guy's name, you've probably heard of him, been around for a while, Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. And then in 1971, I tried to join the Air Force, but I actually flunked my physical to get in, my induction physical, because of an old high school football injury. And so I had to get a waiver to get into the military when most people of good sense were trying to stay out of the military. And after my training, I was sent to a base here in California called Travis Air Force Base, up there by San Francisco. It was an airlift base for the war. GIs would come from all over America to get on the plane to go to Vietnam. And when the planes would come back, they would bring the body bags of the dead soldiers. And on the weekends, there was a protest, almost every single weekend, a protest outside the gate. Most times, 10 or 12 people. Only one time, the whole time I was there, they had a big demonstration. Country Joe and the Fish and Jane Fonda came. They had 500 people. But most of the time, every weekend, 10 to 12 people standing out there with their signs. I can hear them now, forlornly looking at each other. You don't think it does any good to be out here, do you? You don't think we're doing any good, do you? You don't think we'll ever stop this war, do you? Well, I guess we have to be faithful. But little did they know that on our base, besides the thousands of GIs that came and went on the airplanes to go to Vietnam and back, we had 15,000 permanently stationed GIs on our base. And little did they know that their protest, their small little protest on the weekends, got us talking in the barracks, got us talking in the chow hall, got us talking on the job. And in fact, there was a GI resistance movement in the barracks. The first day I checked into the barracks, I checked into a thing called the orderly room. They looked down this clipboard. Oh my God, we've only got one room left. We'll get you out of here as soon as we can. We're sorry. I didn't know what they were talking about. Get your bags. And we walked down this long, dark hallway. Really, we'll get you out of here as soon as we can. I thought it would be a little broom closet with a cot, and I'd be in there for two or three nights. And the guy opened the door, and we walked in. And there were anti-war posters all over the wall. Come to find out, it was the leading GI resistance movement organizer in the barracks. They were keeping him isolated because they were trying to kick him out, but they didn't have enough stuff on him yet. But they only had one room left. And then they forgot about me in there. And so at night, there's a knock on the door. And white guys come in with chairs. And they sit in a circle. And I'm sitting in the corner thinking, my God, these are communists. They're talking about the war. Remember who I am, you know. And then another night, there's a knock on the door. And black guys come in with chairs. They're Black Panthers from the cities talking about racism. And I'm sitting in the corner. I've never seen anything like this in my life. I grew up on military bases behind barbed wire fences. And then they were smoking marijuana. I had heard of it. But I promised you I never inhaled. Not one time. Never. Never. But after about 6 months of this, they started leaving their books around. I started reading them. I was always a curious sort, you know. So I began to, even though I was sitting in the corner, I began to listen to what they had to say. And it made sense. And it changed my life. And so after about 9 months in the military, I decided I was a conscientious objector. And I went and I asked if I could be released. And their first question to me was, well, what's your history? Are you from a Quaker family? No, I'm a young Republican for Nixon from a military family. And so they turned me down. And so I did 3.5 years of what I called hard time. Because after I figured out what was going on, after I read the Pentagon Papers, our government's secret history of how we fabricated the whole pretext to get into the war, it was like being in prison for me. But I got out after 3.5 years, and I was going to school at the University of Florida, where I live in Gainesville, Florida today, just ready to graduate when I got recruited by the United Farm Workers Union, Cesar Chavez's union, to become an organizer of fruit pickers in Florida. And so I left college, never to return, and I became an organizer, and I did that for several years. I went on to coordinate the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice for 15 years, between 83 and 98. And it was in that job that we began to look at what was going on at the Space Center. What are they doing over there? These plutonium launches and these military satellite launches, what's happening? And so I want to share with you some of the things that we learned over the years. In 1992, we created the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And for some years, I coordinated both organizations. But since 98, I've been doing just the Global Network work full-time. Today, we have 165 affiliate groups around the world as part of the Global Network. And we are working to stop the nuclearization and weaponization of space. I think by now most people are beginning to realize that this war today going on in Iraq is a space war. We know that the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, one of the secret agencies of the Pentagon, has been identifying for some time Iraqi targets. And in the opening salvos of that war, the United States had the capability to essentially reduce Iraq's military capability to almost zero within hours. The NRO insignia says we own the night. There's another agency inside the Pentagon that's become a little bit well-known recently, the Information Awareness Office. John Poindexter, the former Iran-Contra figure. You notice their logo here. After this recent hullabaloo about the Information Awareness Office, the folks there, Poindexter and his people, took this logo off their website because they were a bit embarrassed by this all-seeing eye. The whole purpose of the Information Awareness Office is to intercept communications and information about American citizens, ostensibly to protect us from terrorism, but it really is about spying on the American people. They say that the Persian Gulf War back in the early 90s was actually the first space war ever. With U.S. satellite capability, we pre-identified all of Saddam Hussein's military targets before that war even began, just like this time. And in the first 2 days of that war, we bombed over 95% of Saddam Hussein's military capability, leaving in place intentionally 5%, a tiny sliver of capability that we then played cat and mouse with during the remaining weeks of that war, where we used 100 cruise missiles at $1 million apiece, tested out new stealth bombers and new laser weapons. And at that time, a guy by the name of Charles Horner was commander of the Space Command, and he said, "We came out of the war deeply sensitized to the value of space. Future military success," they said, "will depend on space capabilities." So they realized that whoever controlled space would control the Earth. Whoever controlled space would win all the wars on the Earth below. And so today, all warfare in space is coordinated by military satellites. So no matter whether you're a troop on the ground, in a tank, on a boat, or on a plane, everything is coordinated from space. So if you control space, you control the planet. The Kosovo War, the war with Yugoslavia, was the second space war. The Afghanistan War that's still going on is the third space war. And in fact, in the Afghanistan War, and now today over Iraq, the Pentagon has introduced a new weapon system, you've probably all heard of it, called the Unmanned Aerial Vehicle, the UAV, a pilotless plane that is directed by satellite technology, flies over the battlefield, sending back real-time, split-second time, streaming video to General Tommy Franks, who's sitting at his computer screen in Saudi Arabia. He's looking at the ground, pictures from this Predator and another one called the Global Hawk. The Predator has been outfitted with weapons. And so as the Predator flies over Iraq, it identifies a target. And General Frank says, "Is it a Russian ambassador? Is it a Syrian bus? Is it the Republican Guard?" And he can push a button and immediately have the Predator fire in real time, hitting the target on the earth below. It gives the Pentagon the capability to, quote, increase the kill chain. Increase the kill chain. And so this is giving us then real time intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and precision targeting capability over Iraq. A couple years ago, the Pentagon released a report saying that the United States must dominate space in times of war. And in order to do that, they said, we must develop the capability to neutralize and destroy other countries' space assets, meaning their satellites in space. Because if we can see the Earth and direct attack, so could someone else. And so we've got to be able to take them out. This is one of the Pentagon's planning documents called Vision for 2020. Here you see a satellite hitting targets on the Earth below. Let's take a look at some of the language in this so-called Vision for 2020. In a section called Future Trends, they say that because of corporate globalization of the world economy, they expect that there's going to be a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, the rich and the poor around the world. And as a result, there's going to be more and more regional instability around the world as workers who are today under the boot of the multinational corporations are going to try to kick up. They're going to try to organize unions. They're going to try to take their countries back. They're going to protest. And the Pentagon says, you know, we can't put a Marine, try as we may, on every single street corner of the world to suppress these populations, these growing legions of poor people in the future. But with space technology in place, we'll be able to hear everything, see everything, and ultimately target everything on the earth below. And so the Pentagon says, the Space Command says, that space superiority will emerge as an essential element of battlefield success in future warfare. I think this New York Times story from 1999 tells the same thing in a different way. written by a guy you probably heard of, Thomas Friedman. The headline story was called What the World Needs Now. For globalism to work, America can't be afraid to act like the almighty superpower that it is. Now, last year, I did speaking tours in several countries, and I did a six-city tour in France. A lot of people are into French bashing these days, but I'm not. I've been drinking more French wine lately than ever before, actually. But while I was in France, in every single city that I went to, when I showed them this one, people had a reaction to it. And what they said to me was, you know, during World War II, half of France was occupied by the Nazis for several years. We know what fascism looks like. We can taste it. And your country has gone fascist, and you American people don't even know it. Now imagine, how do you respond to that when a room full of people tell you that? What do you say? It's like when I went to Hiroshima and listened to the Habakasha tell me that we know you dropped the bombs on us not to end the war. The war was over. You dropped them as a test. How do you respond to people when they tell you something like that? Now, getting back to this vision for 2020, here they get right down to it. They talk about how we're going to dominate space and how we're going to control space. And they define it. Control of space is the ability to assure access to space, freedom of operations in the space medium, and most importantly of all, they say, an ability to deny others the use of space. We, 5% of the world's population, are going to deny other countries the use of space. At the Space Command headquarters at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, on the building, they have their slogan that reads, Master of Space. And in fact, they wear that as a patch on their uniform. We are going to be the masters of space. This might be hard to see, but this is from an Air Force website called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. The Pentagon today is developing weapons that they can use to change the weather, to use the weather as a battlefield weapon. The idea is, if you can make it rain right before you invade a country or attack a country, you bog them down. They can't get their planes off the ground. Or if you can create a drought condition by changing the weather, you can create such a crisis in an area that they'll have a refugee situation because of the drought. It'll make it easier to go in and invade and take control over a particular part of the world. And so, friends, the scientists and technologists and militarists are out of control. They see themselves literally as God, messing with the creation, if you will. But to understand all of this, I think you have to understand the origins of the U.S. space program. Where did it begin? How did it begin? And to have that understanding, you have to go back to Nazi Germany. The guy with the broken arm is the brilliant young rocket scientist by the name of Wernher von Braun. He was recruited by the man on the left with the hat, Major General Walter Dornberger. Hitler sent Dornberger to ask von Braun, who had a weekend rocket club, and he had a group of friends. They were working on developing rockets, and they asked him to come to work for the Nazis to build the super weapons, the V1 and V2 rockets that Hitler used to terrorize the cities of London and Paris and Brussels with at the end of World War II. And so for von Braun, they created a brand new place called Peenemünde. Up on the Baltic Sea in northern Germany, they made him an SS officer, and they built a whole production and test facility at Peenemünde. And to Peenemünde, the Nazis brought thousands of Jews and French resistance fighters to come and serve as slaves for the operation. Well, the British found out about it, went in and bombed the entire operation. And so the Germans said, we have to move to a more secure location. And so down inside of central Germany, there's a mountain chain called the Harz Mountains. And inside the mountain was a huge tunnel where the Germans were storing military hardware. They cleared it all out. They moved the whole rocket operation inside of there. And they called this place Mittelwerk. And just outside the mountain of Mittelwerk, they created a brand new concentration camp called Dora. And to Dora, the Nazis brought 40,000 Jews, gypsies, French resistance fighters, homosexuals, even a black American GI prisoner of war were brought to this place to serve as the slaves for the Nazis. Well, the slaves began to sabotage the operation. They left screws unturned on the rockets. They urinated on the wires so that when von Braun and his team were launching the rockets, they were going haywire. And so he sent his team in to find out who did this. And they identified 100 of the slaves and summarily hung them inside the mountain in front of everyone as a warning that you will not interfere with the war effort. Well, eventually the Allies even closed in on this place too. And when they arrived, they found some survivors, some emaciated human beings. In fact, one of the first to arrive was an 18-year-old young American GI by the name of Hugh Carey. He later became governor of New York State. But he said when they arrived, what they found was thousands and thousands and thousands of dead bodies lying at their feet, waiting to be shoved into the crematory ovens. The Nazis had fled for the hills. Von Braun and his team had fled for the hills, knowing that if they were apprehended, they would be accused of crimes against humanity. And what the Americans discovered at this place is that 25,000 of the 40,000 slaves at this place perished at the hands of the Nazis. Well, after the war, there was the Nuremberg trials, at which time the Nazis were brought to justice for their crimes against humanity. But 1,500 of the top Nazi scientists never went to trial. They were smuggled into the United States by the U.S. military in a program called Operation Paperclip. Smuggled in through Boston and West Palm Beach, Florida. 100 of them were von Braun and his rocket team, along with 100 copies of the V-2 rocket. They were sent first to White Sands in New Mexico, and then on to Huntsville, Alabama, to create the U.S. space program for the United States. But who were the other 1,400 Nazi scientists, and where did they go? They were the ones that were brought to the United States to create the CIA. Because they knew the names of the communists. They knew who they were. They had been fighting the communists, and they were brought to create the CIA. Then there was the scientists that were brought to the United States that were put in charge of the MK Ultra program, the mind control experiments, and the LSD drug experiments of the 60s, where people, American citizens, were given drugs. They were jumping out of windows, killing themselves. These were the former Nazi scientists who were brought here to create that program. Nazi scientists in Germany that were taking Jews and putting them in freezing temperatures to see how the bodies reacted to the cold. If a pilot was to be shot down over the Baltic Sea, the Nazis wanted to see how the body reacted to freezing temperatures. These guys were sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to create the Air Force's flight medicine program after World War II. And so the entire military-industrial complex of America was seated with the best and brightest of the Nazi scientists. Wernher von Braun was sent on to Huntsville, Alabama, where he became NASA's first director of the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. The former flight test director up at Peenemünde, Kurt Diebus, became the first director of the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The guy that recruited von Braun, Major General Walter Dornberger, became vice president of Bell Aerosystems Corporation in New York that made its riches building the helicopters for the war in Vietnam. And he also was appointed to serve on the first NASA Oversight Committee when NASA was created right after the war. Now, when the military heard that NASA was going to be created, they freaked out. You can't have a civilian space program. The military has to be in charge of space. Don't worry. Don't worry, they were told. From the first day, we're going to have an oversight committee that makes sure that the Pentagon controls the space program. And Major General Walter Dornberger was appointed to that committee. In 1958, testifying before a congressional hearing, Dornberger said that America's top space priority should be to, quote, conquer, occupy, keep, and utilize space between the Earth and the Moon. Later on, in a speech before a national missile industry conference, Dornberger said, "Gentlemen, I didn't come to this country to lose the Third World War. I lost two." And finally, the man that was in charge of production inside the mountain tunnel at Middle Work, Arthur Rudolph, the guy that cracked the whip on the slaves to keep them producing the rockets, he became the project director for NASA's Saturn V rocket program that took the United States to the moon. So these are the origins of the U.S. space program. And so today, when we hear this slogan at the Space Command headquarters, "Masters of Space," I can't help but see an ideological link between that and Deutschland über alles, Germany over all, or Master Race, Master of Space. Now, I know you've all heard of this new program called Missile Defense. The rogue states are going to attack the continental United States. We have to make sure that we can intercept North Korea's missile that does not exist today that can reach the mainland of America, or Iraq's missile that does not exist today that could reach the mainland of America, or Iran's missile that does not exist today that could reach the mainland of our country. They say we've got to be able to have a bullet hit a bullet way up in deep space in order to protect the continental United States. And this program will cost the American people, that Bush now says will be deployed before the next election in 2004, deployed at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California and at Fort Greely in Alaska. As you know, last June, Bush walked away from the ABM treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia, that outlawed these kind of technological developments in the arms race. We walked away from the treaty. Bush now says we're going to deploy missile defense. And just a few weeks ago, Bush made the announcement that we do not even have to test the program. We will deploy without testing, he said, knowing that the tests haven't been going so well. And he's now ruled that we can just deploy it without even fully testing it. And of course, we now know too that this program of so-called missile defense will cost the American taxpayer hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. They say initially we want to have up to 100 interceptors protecting the West Coast. Then we want to put 100 more in North Dakota and maybe even 100 more in the state of Maine, protecting the East Coast of the United States. And how will they pay for this program? Will they raise taxes? No. Bush is cutting taxes for the rich. We now know that 1% of the American people own as much wealth in America as the bottom 95% of the population. And Bush wants to give even more tax cuts to the top 1%. We're not going to raise taxes to pay for Star Wars. We're going to cut education. We're going to cut health care. We're going to cut environmental programs. We're going to break into the Social Security lockbox. That's how we're going to pay for this program. And ultimately, I want to say that this so-called missile defense has absolutely nothing at all to do with defense anyway. It's a Trojan horse. It's not about defending the American people at all. It's about controlling space. It's about dominating space. It's about denying other countries access to space. It's about the United States becoming the master of space. The day before he was sworn in as the Secretary of War by President Bush, Donald Rumsfeld released a report to the nation called the Rumsfeld Space Commission Report. And in that report, this is a page from it, Rumsfeld said that in the coming period, the United States will conduct operations to, from, in, and through space in support of its national interests, both on Earth and in space. And they provided us with this graphic of a new military doctrine called full spectrum dominance. The idea of full spectrum dominance is that the United States must dominate war at every level of conflict. We must dominate the earth with our military on the ground. We must dominate the air above the earth with our air force. And we must dominate the heavens with our weapon systems that are today being developed, many of which are right here in Southern California by Lockheed Martin and Boeing and TRW and Raytheon. But there's a whole nother program besides national missile defense, having a bullet hit a bullet in deep space. There's another program called theater missile defense. Theater missile defense, TMD. The idea of theater missile defense is you don't wait till the missile gets way up into deep space. You forward deploy your systems. You surround the offending third world country or the offending rogue state so that as soon as they try to launch anything, you hit it immediately as soon as it's launched in what's called its boost phase. And so this theater missile defense or boost phase defense is now moving forward as the preferred deployment option of the Bush administration and the Democrats in Congress. The Democrats in Congress have given Bush every single penny in the first 2 years he's been in office that he's asked for these programs. And the Democrats say we must have theater missile defense or boost phase defense in order to protect our troops and ships around the world. And of course, the question is, what are our troops and ships doing all over the world? And of course, the answer is control and domination for the multinational corporations, something the Democrats agree with the Republicans that we as a nation should be doing. Now, theater missile defense or boost phase defense is based three ways. One is on ships, Aegis destroyers that are now being constructed at Bath Iron Works in the state of Maine, ground-based launchers, and the airborne laser, a converted Boeing 747 with a laser beam on its nose that they say will fly 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, over the offending territory. Each of these different systems giving the United States the capability to immediately hit anything that gets lifted off the ground, all coordinated with the new Star Wars satellites that are being developed today by these big weapons corporations. Now, China today has 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the United States. We're the leader of the pack. We have 7,500. Why do we want to surround China with theater missile defense? We'll only provoke them, force them to build more, create a new arms race. It just doesn't make sense, does it? And then I found this article a couple years ago in the Washington Post. The headline reads, "For the Pentagon, Asia moving to the forefront." And the article says that the United States will now manage China. How about that? We're going to manage China. The article goes on to say that we will double our military presence in the Asian Pacific region. We've been lengthening and widening the runways on Guam and Wake Island in the Pacific to handle the B-1 and B-2 bombers. And we've already pre-positioned cruise missiles on Guam. And now we're going to deploy theater missile defense in the Asian Pacific region. Well, let's take a look at the map. This is what we call our unsinkable aircraft carrier, Japan, where today we have 40,000 U.S. troops deployed. And we're going to put theater missile defense in Japan. And right next door in South Korea, we have 40,000 U.S. troops deployed. And in fact, in the last month, Bush has sent even more deployments there of U.S. troops because things have been a bit destabilized there recently. And we're going to put theater missile defense in North Korea. We're going to put theater missile defense in Taiwan and in Australia and on ships and planes, beginning a coastal encirclement of China. And again, how is China going to respond? You remember when Russia and the Soviet Union tried to put nuclear missiles in Cuba, 90 miles off the coast, came into our backyard, our sphere of influence. We almost went to nuclear war over it. But somehow, China is supposed to acquiesce and just turn the other cheek as we do the reverse to them. Well, since 9/11, I look at this map a little differently. I look over here at this region that we now call Central Asia. We now know a little more about it. Where today the United States is establishing permanent military bases in Afghanistan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and other places within that region. And we've all heard Bush say that it's going to be a long, long war. The American people had better be patient, right? Well, I think it's common knowledge now, but the day after 9/11, I went to my world atlas because admittedly I didn't know a great deal about that region. So I looked up these countries. I learned from my experience in the Air Force after reading the Pentagon Papers to always ask the next question. Why? What? Who? How? And of course, now today we all know that Central Asia has some of the largest deposits of oil and natural gas in the entire world. How many of you know who a guy by the name of Zbigniew Brzezinski is? Remember, he worked for Jimmy Carter. He was his national security advisor, the same job Condoleezza Rice has today. Well, he wrote a book in 1997 called The Grand Chessboard. I want to show you two pages from his book. Remember, it was written in 1997. He says that the United States must build oil pipelines through this region of the Middle East and Central Asia so that we will be able to control the flow of oil. He particularly points out that with a pipeline through Afghanistan, I don't know if you can see this, but it says Unocal pipeline, that with this pipeline through Afghanistan, it would allow the United States to move oil into the Arabian Sea that we can then take to emerging markets throughout the Asian Pacific region. It's interesting that at that same time in 1997, I saw it on the Congressional Record website, that a Unocal vice president testified before the Congress of the United States. He pleaded with the Congress to help Unocal have a more compliant government in Afghanistan that would allow the construction of an oil pipeline through their country. And in the second page from Brzezinski's book, he talks about two key collision points, as he calls them, in this part of the world. He says, in order for the United States to control this part of the world in the coming period, we must control two key collision points. One being the coastal region around China, where today we are now planning to deploy theater missile defense. And the other is the Central Asian region where today we are building, we have built bases to control this part of the world. Checkmate. Russia. Look at Russia's proximity. Look where China is. Checkmate on the world. If you look at this map again, you look at Iran. Some people say that's the next one we might invade. Look how we now have Iran surrounded with bases in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and throughout this region here with bases in Saudi Arabia. Or some people are saying, next we're going to go after Syria in this endless war that Bush has declared on the world. This is a page from a Space Command planning document called Long Range Plan. It's not just the Middle East or Central Asia that the United States wants to control. It's the entire planet. Their vision is to control the entire planet Earth through space technology. This plane up here is what they call the military space plane that is being developed today and will be sold to us as the successor to the shuttle. You know, we've been having some problems with the shuttle fleet. It's getting a little old and unreliable. We're going to have to upgrade it. And so we're going to build the military space plane that just coincidentally will be used to participate in war in space. And then, of course, the space-based laser is also now under development, and the new Star Wars satellites under development as well. About a year and a half ago, Aviation Week and Space Technology, one of the leading industry magazines, reported on a computer war game that had just taken place at the Space Command headquarters in Colorado. It was set in the year 2016. It was the blue team versus the red team. And in that computer war game, the United States launched a preemptive first strike attack on China. Now, a year and a half ago, people used to kind of snicker at me when I would use those words, preemptive first strike attack. Some people would raise their hand and say, you know, our country would never do that. But now, of course, you all know that that's the official military doctrine of our government today. That's what we've just done with Iraq, preemptive first strike attack. And in this preemptive first strike attack in the year 2016, the United States launched an attack on China, and the first weapon that was used in the war was the successor to the shuttle, the military space plane that flew down from orbit, dropped an attack on China, and then went back up again. And the second weapon that was used in that war game was the space-based laser, firing from space and hitting targets on the Earth below. In 1989, I organized a demonstration at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, one of many that I've organized over the years there. But what made that one particularly important for us was we had an Apollo astronaut come and speak. His name was Edgar Mitchell. He was one of the early moonwalkers, and he came to speak out against space weapons. He said, we can't let the Pentagon put weapons in space. He said, in fact, we can't even let them test weapons in space. He said, because today there is so much space junk orbiting the Earth, space debris, at 18,000 miles an hour, that if we even test weapons in space by, let's say, blowing up an old satellite, we will create so much more space junk that we will not be able to get a rocket off the planet Earth. We'll be entombed to the planet because we won't be able to get through the minefield of space junk. Today there are 110,000 pieces of space junk larger than a half of an inch orbiting the Earth, so many that they track them on the big radar screen at NORAD in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. Recently, the International Space Station, originally they said it was going to cost $10 billion. Today the price tag is $100 billion, by the way. They had to move the space station to another orbit because they said space junk was coming dangerously close and they were afraid they were going to collide. Some scientists say they'll never finish construction of the space station because it will be destroyed before it's even finished. Who knows? In this particular graphic from Harper's Magazine, they point to this one little speck here, And they say this is one of 34 nuclear reactor cores that will fall back to Earth in the next 1,000 years. Come to find out, since the beginning of the space age, since the early 60s, the United States and the former Soviet Union have launched over 40 nuclear reactors, military satellites, orbiting the Earth. Some powered by uranium, some powered by plutonium. And there have already been eight accidents falling back to Earth. The worst was 1964. U.S. military satellite with 2 pounds of plutonium fell back to Earth, burned up on reentry, similar to the Columbia accident recently that we all witnessed. The plutonium turned to dust. It was carried by the winds across the planet to be ingested by the people into our lungs, where we will receive leukemia and then passed on through our reproductive organs for generations after generations to come. Dr. John Goffman, one of the founders of uranium at Lawrence Livermore Labs up in Berkeley, studied that particular accident and believes it's one of the major contributors to the increase in cancers around the Earth today. And now the Bush administration, just a couple months ago, has announced a $3 billion research and development program to increase the numbers of nuclear launches in the coming years. Project Prometheus, one of them, a nuclear rocket with nuclear reactors for engines taking us to Mars in half the time that conventional rockets would take to get there. In this book by a NASA scientist, he says there's gold on the asteroids. There's magnesium and cobalt and uranium on Mars. There's helium-3 and water on the moon. And he says whoever gets to these planetary bodies and controls them is going to be rich beyond anything we've ever imagined in the history of the Earth. But the number one problem today, he says, is that launch costs are too expensive per pound. It's not cost effective today to go out and mine the sky. So NASA's number one job is to lower the cost of launching. And that's why they're creating the nuclear rocket and other such nuclear programs. Well, I want to share with you this book written by a congressional staffer, John Collins. He was asked by the Congress of the United States to write the definitive study. How's this whole thing going to look in 50 years? How are we going to do this? How's it going to work? What are we going to need? How are we going to make it happen? And this is his report to the Congress of the United States. Now, you know how people sign the foreword of a book. They say, we'd like to recommend you read it and see if you recognize any of the names of people that signed this foreword. That's right, John Glenn. John Kasich, you're talking about, former congressman from Ohio. Bill Nelson, he's now the senator from Florida, used to be the congressman from Cape Canaveral, went up on the space shuttle. Ike Skelton from St. Louis, Democrat, who's a big-time proponent of weapons corporations. They got some big contractors in St. Louis. John Spratt from South Carolina. Nancy Pelosi is the new leader of the Democratic Party in the House, named John Spratt as one of her leading lieutenants in her new committee of people. Let's look at some of the things in this book. The author talks about what he calls the Earth-Moon gravity well. He says, think of it like a wishing well. Imagine someone is down inside the bottom of a well, and you're at the top. You put a lid on it, they can't get out, right? You control who gets in and out of the well. He said it's the same way. If we have bases on the moon, he says, and armed space stations at the L4 and L5 positions on either side of the moon, we can control who gets on and off the planet Earth. And the author says that with our armed forces lying in wait at that location, we could hijack rival shipments upon return. So if anyone else tried to go out and mine the sky, but they were not authorized, we could take them out on the way back. Because remember, we're going to be the masters of space. And so I realized that the Space Command's job is not just to help us control the Earth for the multinational corporations, but in the future vision, the Space Command's job will be to create a parallel military highway between the Earth and the Moon, the Earth and the Mars, the Earth and the planetary bodies, to control the shipping lanes in the future, so that we will control the pathways to the new world. And you, the taxpayers, will pay for it. I call this pyramids to the heavens. The weapons corporations are the new pharaohs of our age, building these pyramids to the heavens. And we, the taxpayers, will be the slaves who will turn over everything we have, our children's future, our hopes and dreams, even our measly little Social Security check, so they can build this stuff. And you know what? To add insult to injury, they've introduced legislation. You might have heard of a guy by the name of Dana Rohrabacher down from around here. Introduced legislation saying that when the day comes when they can turn profit in space, they want to privatize the whole operation and make all profits in space tax-free. Yeah. And the author says, fundamentally, none of this is possible without nuclear reactors. Nuclear reactors, he says, thus remain the only known, long-lived, compact source able to supply the kind of multi-megawatt power they're going to need in space. Larger versions, he says, of these nuclear reactors would provide power for things like space-based lasers, neutral particle beams, mass drivers, and rail guns. Nuclear reactors must support major bases on the moon until better options yet identified are found. And then he concludes here with safety factors, rather than technological feasibility, will remain the principal impediment to nuclear power in space unless officials can convince influential critics that risks are acceptably low. I want to remind you of one of my early slides. Major General Walter Dornberger, the Nazi that recruited von Braun in 1958, testifying before the Congress of the United States, Dornberger said, America's top space priority should be to, quote, conquer, occupy, keep, and utilize space between the Earth and the Moon. Come to find out, it was the Nazi Walter Dornberger that first had the idea of so-called ballistic missile defense. It was Walter Dornberger that first had the idea of orbiting battle stations, the space-based laser in space. The Nazi vision has come to fruition today in the halls of the Congress of the United States of America and at the weapons laboratories all over the state of California and Florida and Texas and all over America. The Nazi vision has reached fruition in America today. But it's not over yet. They always have an Achilles heel. And in this case, they have two problems. Number one, the technology is not yet developed. It's a plan, and they're working it, and it's being heavily funded, and they got more money than they can spend right now. And I'm telling you right now, you give them enough time, and you give them enough money, these guys are brilliant. They've taken us to Mars. They will develop weapons in space if we let them, but they've not yet done it. And the other Achilles heel is the cost. That all over this country, people have aspirations for their children. They want their children to have a good future. They want their children to have education. People want health care. And they want clean drinking water and clean air. And all of that costs money. And so right now, we're getting our asses kicked in the halls of the Congress. And they're taking the money out of these programs and putting it into Star Wars. But it's coming to a head. I happen to be lucky that I do a lot of traveling. In every community I go to right now, just as in your state, you have a fiscal crisis. Every community in this country has a fiscal crisis. And these two things are running headlong into each other in America. The dream for a stable, sustainable life is running headlong into a dream of an unstable arms race in the heavens. And one of them is going to lose. It's up to the American people to determine which way it's going to go. As I look at that night sky, after tonight, after talking, I'll go outside, and I've learned, after being on the road for the last 3 years, 3 weeks out of every month, all over this country and all over this world, trying to build a constituency, a new consciousness about space, trying to build a group of people around the world that will intervene before it's too late. And every night when I go out, I look for that moon in a different shape. And I realize that every single person on this planet has some kind of personal relationship with that night sky, with that moon and those stars. It's the unifying symbol of the planet, isn't it? We all understand it. It's all in us. It's been in us for thousands of years. When our forefathers and our relatives long before us used to lay at night around their council fires and look up at that starry sky and wonder the eternal questions. Where do we come from? Where do we go when we die? What's life all about? And I realize that this is the seed of our hope. The fact is that people all over this planet now are organizing to stop this madness. Today, as I said before, we have 165 affiliate groups on virtually every continent of the world organizing to stop Star Wars. And why is this? It's because the Pentagon, in order to make this whole thing work, has had to build radar receiving stations all over the world to communicate with the satellites. And so in England, in Australia, in Germany, in Japan, all over the world, people are suddenly thrown into the middle of this Star Wars program, whether they like it or not. And they are now organizing because they don't want these facilities in their country. They don't want to have a role in Star Wars. They don't want to participate in moving the arms race to the heavens. And this gives us a global constituency that is now working all over this planet. And so we realize that here in America, we don't have to stop this thing by ourselves. That we just have to join a global movement that is already in motion. And if we've seen anything in recent weeks, is that there is a global peace movement today. The whole world gets it. The whole world understands what our country's up to. The whole world is speaking out. There's an arc of history being made right now around the world. The people of the world are the second great superpower in the world today. And it's really up to the American people to join that movement. I hope you will help us in whatever way you can to begin to integrate this space consciousness into your peace work in this community, to help people understand that we cannot move this bad seed of war and greed and environmental degradation into the heavens, because if we do, it will be our doom. Thank you very much.
That was Bruce Gagnon, Director of Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, speaking in Santa Monica, California last week. For more information on the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, visit their website at www.spaceforpeace.org. That's space, the numeral 4, peace.org. Thanks to Dave Adelson and the LA Sound Posse for that tape. And also to Mariah Gallardin of TUC Radio for the material in the first hour of the program. And thanks to Scooter and the Christmas Coup Comedy Players from New York City for the updated version of Love Me Like a Rock. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. For more information on the program, or to hear previous shows you might have missed, visit our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. And if you're listening to this program on 88.1 in Ithaca, and you appreciate what you're hearing, please consider making a donation to help support Ithaca Community Radio. Some members of the community have incurred about $10,000 worth of expenses out of pocket in order to put a transmitter on the air on 88.1 in Ithaca. To find out how to support the Ithaca Community Radio Project, visit www.ithacaradio.org. Thank you, and thanks for listening.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.